Coming up on a Humankind special, we visit Charlottesville, Virginia. That's where hundreds of torch-bearing white supremacists descended in the summer of 2017.
I caught somehow or another a video, streaming video, that a student was taking of the people that were marching with their torches through the grounds, and I was horrified.
Faculty and students at the University of Virginia recall the startling events of that weekend, including fatal violence on the campus personally designed by Thomas Jefferson. We hear about efforts there today to promote respect for diversity and greater self-reflection. Also, we visit a remarkable middle school in San Francisco, where eighth graders can teach us all about conflict resolution. I'm David Freudberg. Stay tuned for Humankind after this news. Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston. This special documentary project is supported by the Communitude Initiative at the University of Minnesota School of Nursing and by the Humankind Program Fund. You're listening to a Humankind special, Whole Teachers, Whole Students. I'm David Freudberg.
One of my favorite things to share with the students is be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. We're all in this together, whether it's a physical battle, emotional, social.
That's Professor David Mick, who teaches in the business school at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, a campus founded two centuries ago by Thomas Jefferson. David leads a popular and somewhat unlikely seminar for a professor of commerce. It's known as Wisdom and Well-Being. It draws on his long personal interest in philosophy and meditative practice. The aim is to produce wise, self-aware leaders and citizens. But that mission was sorely tested in the summer of 2017.
Today was a very sad day for our great Commonwealth and the city of Charlottesville. We know as now three fatalities today, in addition to many individuals who have been hurt.
Terry McAuliffe, then the governor of Virginia, after what the Washington Post called a day of rage, hate, violence, and death.
All right, I want to remind you that you're in custody, okay? So you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand those rights? All right, with those rights in mind, do you wish to answer?
That Friday night, some 250 males, mostly young, assembled on a large grassy field behind the gymnasium. They were part of a white supremacist movement and heavily armed. The marchers carried tiki torches, evoking Hitler youth gatherings and Ku Klux Klan rallies from the last century. They chanted, "Jews will not replace us, and you will not replace us," and blood and soil.
Somehow or another, a video, streaming video, that a student was taking of the people that were marching with their torches through the grounds, and I was horrified.
Patricia Jennings, associate professor of education at the University of Virginia. Her academic focus is research about reducing student and teacher stress.
As I was following it, I was hearing this student narrate that she didn't see any campus police. She saw students at the statue of Jefferson out in the front of the rotunda being surrounded and accosted. It was stunningly horrifying.
Tish has devoted her career to enhancing the capacity of teachers to foster supportive learning environments. She was shocked by the arrival on campus of a large horde of neo-Nazis.
I felt frozen, I guess is the best way to explain it. I couldn't make sense out of it, and I stayed away from everything that was happening because I didn't feel safe enough to actually go in or do anything.
The next day, Saturday, a rally by the white nationalists was scheduled to begin at noon at a city park. They were protesting removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. They wielded clubs and shields and carried firearms. Some held Nazi flags and Confederate flags and gave the Nazi salute. Counter-protesters also assembled. Violence was in the air and soon erupted.
It was almost seemed unimaginable.
David Mick.
It just seemed like it overtook the city. It seemed almost by surprise, although obviously the plans had been in place for some of these, the neo-Nazis and so forth, to come to Charlottesville. I, too, was not downtown or on campus. Frankly, I, like a lot of people, was just scared about what was about to possibly happen.
At one point, 20-year-old James Alex Fields from Ohio, an avowed neo-Nazi, accelerated his car into a group of counter-protesters. Left dead was an anti-racism demonstrator, 32-year-old Heather Heyer. Injured were 35 others. Fields was later found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. Governor McAuliffe.
I have a message to all the white supremacists and the Nazis who came into Charlottesville today. Our message is plain and simple. Go home. You are not wanted in this great commonwealth. Shame on you. You pretend that you're patriots, but you are anything but a patriot. Our diversity, that mosaic tile of immigrants, is what makes us so special. And we will not let anybody come here and destroy it.
The normally peaceful campus, personally designed by Thomas Jefferson to be what he called an academical village, was left dazed and grief-stricken in August of 2017. Patricia Jennings.
And the aftermath was quite striking because I didn't feel like the university had really stepped up to the plate to address it as quickly as I would have liked. And so it kind of felt like a lingering wound here for a while.
This is an area of the United States where there was a lot of bloodshed many, many years ago during the Civil War.
David Mick.
There's a lot of economic challenges in the surrounding rural areas, not just in Virginia, but other parts of the country. And I just sort of feel like this is a reflection of a kind of a hopelessness, a lot of anxiety, as we've gone through difficult economic and racial development, if you will, times, as most of us want to see more equity and justice and fairness for all. And there's a lot of people that are really are hurting in this country and who, for whatever reasons, have decided to express it in very scary, problematic ways.
Also that August, a rising first-year student from New York City, Nia Augustine, who plans to be a physician, was preparing to start her college life at UVA.
You automatically assume like racism or just like discrimination is something that's no longer as prevalent as it was before just because it's the 21st century now.
She remembers hearing about the violence that summer before arriving on campus.
I expected it to be lively. It's your first year. Like it's a fresh start where you get to discover and be yourself. And I just didn't feel that anymore. And I feel like the atmosphere on grounds was just so tense that you can just take a pin and just push it through it. And you can definitely feel it, like, especially being a Black woman and being in the Black community, you can definitely feel that segregation between the Black and the white community here on grounds, in that are these people, are the white population really, like, are they all have that hidden agenda as well? Like, who attended the march, and what side of the march were they on?
Quite a lot to sort out for someone living in a new region trying to make sense of her first year at college.
It was definitely unsettling. I know that, especially coming from an area with Brooklyn, New York, which is so diverse, and just coming here and just feeling like even more of a minority, but now being in a space where you know that, it's like you're even, like you're hyper aware of who you are in every space that you're in. And it was just very unsettling and uncomfortable to even like be in classes and be the only Black person and kind of having to like speak up and stand up for your race and your gender.
the white nationalists who came to Charlottesville did so much to divide us, and it has kind of put a wedge even more in the campus environment than there was before.
Benji Beardsley was off campus when the street violence flared in 2017. He studies leadership and public policy at the university. Benji is affiliated there with the Contemplative Sciences Center, which researches and teaches the practice of self-reflection as part of a person's spiritual journey.
So I think kind of being able to take a step back and, you know, listen to yourself and, you know, realize that we are all, you know, fundamentally as humans looking for the same things, you know, that is, you know, happiness, and, you know, just meaning in life, and that these discussions are very important, but that ultimately as students, you know, we are here to be companions to one another, and coming at these issues from a, you know, conflict and from an aggressive stance isn't going to help anyone. And I think that's on both sides.
Benji developed an interest in contemplative practices after studying Buddhism and yoga. He tries to apply that big picture to the field of public policy.
I also think that the political environment has gotten so polarized that people just aren't really willing to listen to each other. And I think that college is really much like a microcosm of that political environment. You see a reflection of all these trends happening on a national scale, even more in a college environment. And I think people are also discovering their political identities in college. So you do tend to see that amplified more. But what I will say is the day I got back, there was the candlelight vigil, and that was really a beautiful ceremony to see everyone come together.
Benji notes that in the aftermath of the Charlottesville tragedy, UVA removed some Confederate plaques from the rotunda, and they tightened the rules about groups gathering on the lawn, which is a public space. Examining how schools can develop students' skills for self-reflection and social sensitivity to better equip young people who will face our world's mounting challenges. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, part one of Whole Teachers, Whole Students, to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org.
Have to be able to take time and reflect to ask ourselves, what is the life that we have and what is it that we want? And by doing that, we are evoking a kind of opportunity to slow down and think through what's most important to us.
University of Virginia business professor David Mick knows that focusing on these fundamental questions allows students to make clearer choices. When they have a sense of their deep values, of who they are, they're less conflicted and more productive.
One of the tensions we see in high school and in many colleges is this: the urge to get job skills, to get the technical skills, and they want that because they know they have to finally go out into the world and make a living. But at the same time, when you engage them in these other bigger, difficult, complex questions, you find that they light up because they really want to talk about this, and very often it's not going on near as enough as it should.
This is Newcomb Hall, a large dining room for students at the University of Virginia. It offers a deli, a grill, a vegetarian station, and of course a selection of pizzas. Students come here to socialize and unwind from the academic pressures of a world-class college. They're acquiring knowledge at the fast pace of high-tech communication.
Where I personally come from in my own teaching is, again, I'll come to a quote that's one of my favorites that some folks certainly are aware of, and is where T.S. Eliot, in the midst of a long epic poem written almost 100 years ago, said, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge?" So we have produced a lot of knowledge through science, whether it's the computer, it can be transportation, it can be also warfare and other kinds of things. We have this knowledge, but in the rush to all this knowledge through science, we've not sufficiently asking what's wise about the application of all of these things in a way that can help us to reach a stronger, more stable, and more far-reaching common good, which includes people having their basic needs met and getting an opportunity to have some purpose in their life with what they do.
Discerning what's wise and what's not is, for many of us, a lifelong journey of discovery. It's not a proficiency that's fully mastered in college. So David Mick's goal as a professor is to provide the future leaders he's grooming with a solid foundation that they can build upon.
In my own work with students and what I'm teaching is I do come at it from a wisdom perspective, and people will often write in terms of theory of wisdom that there are these pillars, so like patience and gratitude, taking both short-term and long-term viewpoints, understanding what resilience is in life, to face struggles and work through them, and understand important lessons that give you hope for the future, to be flexible, and also pillars of compassion and moral reasoning, but also mindfulness. That's another one, is how do we become aware of our body, our own thoughts, what's going on around us, so we can more consciously choose what our own words or our actions will be that will be the most suitable, the most skillful in order to reach for a better common good.
I want to just touch briefly on the contemplative practices and the contemplative science for a moment.
Education professor Tish Jennings.
Especially practicing mindful awareness can make a big difference in the way we understand our situation because it gives us a little tiny bit of space between our automatic tendencies and our ability to make good choices and good decisions that take into account a bigger picture than just my individual needs. And I think the reason that mindfulness is very popular right now is because in a way it is allowing us to reflect. It's giving us the tools to reflect, which a deeper kind of reflection that touches not only our thoughts and our understanding, but also our history and our biology and what's going on inside of how we feel. It touches into that. When they learn that you can actually focus on that, the students focus on their intention and differentiate between intention and goals, because they're very goal-oriented. You know, achieve this, achieve this, achieve this, achieve this. But intention is different. Intention is more about direction, and it's more about being than doing. It's more about the aims and direction that I'm headed, not the goalposts. But am I going the way that I want to be going? Am I acting the way I want to act? And so I teach them how to do this in a regular basis where they sit, they contemplate that, they consider the intention short-term, long-term, and they focus on it. And I find that the students touch into a part of themselves that has been kind of neglected for a while because they've been so academically oriented, so cognitively oriented. They're touching into something that they feel in their bodies. And parts of them open up to this in ways that really surprise me.
You know, wisdom has been written and talked about in a lot of different ways over the years.
David Mick.
But it's very common to say that there's two kinds of wisdom. One is the more practical, thinking about gratitude, thinking about compassion, thinking about resilience, thinking about intention and so forth. But there is also the more intuitive, okay, and a kind of a quietude, a kind of just settling for a moment and letting there be the possibility that wisdom will rise up in you at any given moment as to the right thing to do, and whether you're helping someone with something or not, or whether you're going to take a trip, or whether you're going to spend your money in one way or another, or are you going to follow one career path over another. Oftentimes, it's not just a lot of cognition in a reflective way, but also this kind of reaching a kind of a quiet where you can see if something were to kind of become apparent to you that was there in the background and now becomes very clear.
In my personal life, I meditate.
UVA student Nia Augustine.
Well, at least I try to meditate every morning just to kind of center myself and bring awareness to the emotions that I'm feeling right now, the emotions from the previous day. And I try to incorporate journaling as well in my routine just to get everything out on paper so that I'm aware that my emotions, my feelings are valid. Because I think that this is something that's very common today, that people just disregard their emotions. Like, oh, okay, I felt this because of blah, blah, blah. And not taking the time to go deeper into themselves and realizing why those emotions actually fired up out of nowhere.
It allows us to understand that these reactions that we experience, either psychological, mental, cognitive, physical, whatever you want to call it, are simply reactions that we can observe and that we can make choices to override. And in that sense, mindfulness is becoming kind of a biohack. It's a way of hacking this automatic fight, flight, or freeze response that's embedded in our bodies. And in order to expand our ability to understand one another, show kindness to one another, even people who might be doing things that we really don't like or that we disagree with, learning how to do this gives us the capacity to not only understand that other person's perspective and understand our own perspective, but also to create ways to extend beyond these automatic human reactive tendencies that we have.
The heart of it lies at, you know, the way we relate to each other and the way that we can talk about these issues in a healthy and balanced way.
Student Benji Beardsley.
Seeing each other's perspectives as valid and legitimate, and, you know, recognizing that some people are affected by these issues a lot more than others, and, you know, giving a platform to those voices to actually be heard in a way that facilitates legitimate action as opposed to just lip service. But I think before you engage in any of that kind of discussion, people need to take a step back and, you know, look inwards and realize, you know, why they might be having the positions that they're having. And it's totally fine if you have a disagreement with someone, because, you know, that is democracy and that is freedom of speech. But also you need to be able to recognize that, like, you have a lot more in common with people than you do disagreements.
Try to understand where one person is coming from and allow them to tell you, and don't like place different stereotypes that society has placed on certain groups of people on them. Like, give people the chance to actually tell you about themselves so you can learn about them. And by that, you can foster connections and even build empathy and even have compassion towards them as well.
I think the key is finding value in new connections, even the smallest connections, and in those connections, recognizing the similarities and differences.
This is Tara Srivastava, a pre-med student with a focus on cognitive science.
The hardest part of this process, at least from what I've gathered so far, I know there's a lot I have to learn, but it's introspecting and internalizing your quote-unquote flaws to be able to learn about yourself and learn how you function and how you don't, it's not conducive for you to function, and that where your weaknesses lie, in order to be able to see them in other people and see how, like, other people are human. They have these weaknesses. This might be going on with them that I can see in myself. And so when you learn how to, I think, connect on that level where you see your own weaknesses and you're able to understand them in other people, that's the hardest part, and maybe one of the hardest parts in building empathy, is that self-development process.
Some of the coursework in developing these life skills includes keeping a diary of things a student is grateful for, a way to restore a balanced perspective, and writing an essay on resilience, reflecting on how we get past difficulties and how lessons learned might be helpful in mentoring others. Nia Augustine.
I remember going back to my human flourishing class on what is your purpose in life, and something that an important identity of mine is religion, and I have this, and my belief is that I was put on this earth with a purpose, and that purpose was to serve God, and that's by helping others. So that is something that I feel like that's where my purpose comes from, is from helping others. And by helping others, I have this sense of belonging and my ability to just help others and share love and kindness. I think that's what my purpose in life is. And whether that be medicine or something else, I'm fine with that. But just the fact that I can help someone and just spread that love and let them know that they belong, that's what I'm becoming to realize is super important to me, especially as I navigate college and beyond.
Nia Augustine, a pre-med student at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Coming up, we'll visit an amazing middle school in San Francisco where eighth graders seem wise beyond their years. It's due in part to some visionary educators who believe that to raise healthy, whole students requires healthy, whole teachers. When Humankind continues in a moment.